This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. Our theme today is the environment in the face of a major oil refinery fire in Northern California at a Chevron refinery. We'll be speaking live with Antonia Duhas, the author of Tyranny of Oil and the former director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange. We will then take a deeper look into what has been happening in the Gulf of Mexico, the other area that is victim of a major American oil spill. We'll speak live with Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network on the latest details about that dispersant that was used in the Macondo disaster, the BP oil spill. All that and more coming up on today's 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And there are continuing consequences from a major fire at a Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, in the northern part of the state, where there were continuing fumes and concerns among residents that there may be toxins in those fumes. The issue was the subject of a very boisterous town hall meeting last night, and the subject of a press conference by the mayor of Richmond, California, Gail McLaughlin.
And to all of you for coming out. You know, it's our plight in Richmond, our collective plight being in the shadow of this big refinery that binds us. And it drives us. It drives us to continue to struggle for justice. And that's why today is so important. It brings people together. It brings the community together to tell Chevron why they need to do better by us. We need a full investigation with full accountability and transparency from them as to the cause of this fire, this series of explosions, and this rain of black cloud and toxins over our heads yesterday. It's essential that we call for this, and I also want to see an independent analysis. I know we have wonderful groups that do such scientific analysis, like Communities for a Better Environment. There's people at UC Berkeley that the community offers its analysis by way of its throat problems, its asthma problems, and you know the way this situation impacted all of us, all of you. That's really what we need to have Chevron understand. It's really important that you raise your voices. You continue to stand for environmental justice. You continue to stand for economic justice. Because Chevron, of course, let's not forget, keeps appealing its property taxes as if they are exempt from much time. I know you got other people to speak, but I'm here with you. I'm in the town hall meeting. I'm in conversations with Chevron, and I'm telling them they got to do right by the community of Richmond.
The statement of the mayor of Richmond, California, Gail McLaughlin, at a town hall meeting of some concern for residents in the plume of the oil refinery fire that occurred at a facility operated by the Chevron Corporation. We're now joined by the former director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange and the author of The Tyranny of Oil in the person of Antonia Duhas. And welcome to 5 o'clock shadow, Antonia.
Thanks for having me. Good evening.
Well, what is the latest development and the state of the fire and of the residua, the fumes and the downstream effects?
Sure. As images that have been on television have made clear, just an enormous fire and giant plume spread out across the Bay Area. An estimated about 160,000 people received shelter-in-place warnings. And just so people know what that is, I mean, it literally is you shut your windows, shut your doors, turn off your air conditioning, bring in your pets, bring in your kids, try and find a room that has no windows and no access to air and stay there until we tell you it's over. And that was for many hours. In fact, you're actually supposed to have duct tape available so that you, if instructed, can seal your windows. One problem is that automatic announcement only went out to about 18,000 people whereas, as I said, about 160,000 were in those immediate threat warning areas, and then even more were told not to go outside and breathe the air out of concern about that spreading cloud. The good news is that because of winds, the chemicals were likely more dissipated than they would have been had they just sat like an umbrella over Richmond. The bad news is that means that the chemicals were spread out all across the Bay Area. And the latest numbers are that about 1,000 people have already reported to hospitals for health concerns. And those have been respiratory, breathing issues, eyes watering as well, headaches. And those are the short-term effects that we know about. Chevron says that it is still maintaining what it's calling a controlled burn. That means the fire is still burning, and they think it makes sense to keep it burning, probably burning off excess natural gas. But a fire is a fire at a refinery, so we won't feel good until it's completely out. But the immediate danger is certainly over, and the major fire is certainly over.
The location of the refinery in Richmond, how many miles away is it from San Francisco?
About 17 miles from San Francisco.
Very close. So that means that any of the polluted fumes that come from such a fire are subject to the foggy stasis of the bay there?
Yeah, but they didn't really settle over the city. They didn't make it as far as into downtown San Francisco. But, as I said, even though I live in San Francisco, I'm still pretty concerned about the 160,000 other people who were exposed.
The ability of medical and fire and health personnel to respond, do you think that was adequate for the population at risk downwind of this?
Well, the certainly fire crews got there in a timely manner. Chevron has its own fire crews, and then the city is there. Like I said, the biggest failure was simply alerting the populace of what was happening and to what they needed to be concerned about. Unfortunately, bad fumes come from the refinery all the time. So just smelling it doesn't mean that you know that this is a more serious incident if you couldn't see the fire or hear what many people are describing as explosions that they heard, even though Chevron denies at this point that there were explosions. And there was a delay in the automated a call by at least 10 minutes. And then this is an incredibly multi-ethnic and diverse population right by the refinery. 85% of the people who live within 3 miles of the refinery are considered minorities by the U.S. Census. They speak a wide range of languages, and the multi-ethnic system, or the multi-language system, completely fell down, according to community groups that have worked very hard to get it in place in the first place. It basically just didn't happen.
The concerns that you raise about notification caused me to consider even greater alarms. One of the most highly funded departments of the United States government is Homeland Security. And then there is also FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Administration. Were they present or effective in any way, given the lack of notification and other rapid responses?
I don't know how that works. Unfortunately, fires at refineries are extremely common in the United States. These happen a lot. This is a very big one, but it's not even a very big one in comparison to Chevron has had two previous major explosions and fires at this refinery just in the last 12 years. Just in the last as many weeks, there have been about six fires at refineries across the United States. My guess is that neither FEMA nor Homeland Security is brought in each case because there's just too many. And I would imagine Homeland Security would be notified, but doesn't qualify to the level of FEMA, and they knew right away that it was a standard failure, unfortunately, not a terrorist attack, because in each case, including this one, at this refinery, a leaking pipe, an old leaking pipe, is the cause. So that's been the case in each major incident here. Basically, they're just not keeping this refinery or refineries all across the United States, they're not keeping them well cared for. So an old leaky pipe leaks gas that then interacts with the many flammable things that are at refineries, and you get explosions and fires. And that's, again, what happened here. The third time in a dozen years, an old leaking pipe leads to a massive public health, and public health certainly damage and worker safety scare.
The hazards to the atmosphere and respiration are obvious here, but are there also possible consequences to the water table and or the bay and the ocean in the operation of this refinery?
Certainly, you know, just depends on where these chemicals lay down. You know, in general, this refinery, like, again, so many across the United States, just runs in constant non-compliance with federal standards, and that includes the Clean Water Act, it includes the Clean Air Act, and a number of other national laws that the federal government is supposed to enforce. And this refinery has been in non-compliance for the Clean Water Act for years. It's been in high priority violation. That's the highest level of violation of the Clean Air Act for years. It only recently got out of that category. But it continues to face, because of public pressure, hundreds of thousands of dollars over many years in fines for its violations. And that's just the way they operate. They spew excess pollution into the air and in the water. And it's these local refinery towns that bear the brunt of this, you know, misuse and abuse by this industry, you know, not only here in Richmond, but again, all across the country. Just a month ago, the Chemical Safety Board, which is a a public investigative unit of the federal government that investigates problems at U.S. refineries, said that you know, it's been almost a decade since the BP the BP Texas City disaster in which 15 workers were killed, and at that time they said, you know, no refinery in the United States is following good safety practices. All of them are cutting costs. All of them are cutting corners. We're worried about all of the refineries. Just last month, they said the same problem persists. We don't see that they've learned any lessons in the last decade. We're worried about all of the refineries. And then less than a month later, we have this, you know, massive fire with Chevron, which is, you know, the largest corporation in California, the eighth largest corporation on the planet, $27 billion in profits last year. There's no reason why they can't run the safest, healthiest, most transparent refinery possible. They're just not, and we're not forcing them to.
We're speaking with Antonia Juhas. She is the author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry, and the author-editor of alternative annual reports about the Chevron Corporation and former director of Global Exchange's Chevron program. And Antonia, you refer to the particular risk that the multicultural population near the refinery faced. I'm wondering if there are other hazards of the refinery. Where does the crude come from to be refined there? And are there ancillary risks with shipping or piping or trucking the material in to be refined?
I mean, again, that's a problem with refineries, all across the United States. You know, the oil is a mess from exploration to production to transport to refining to distribution. And all along the chain, there are incidents and accidents and constant sources of pollution. One victory here, however, after which continues to be a struggle, but it's been so far a victory, is that what Chevron gets most of its oil for this refinery, either that it produces itself here in California, it ships in from the Middle East, a lot of that oil comes here, and from Central and Latin America. What it's wanted to do for some time, however, is refine the much heavier and dirtier Canadian tar sand oil at this refinery. And that oil is just heavier and more sulfur-laden, dirtier oil than the traditional sources of oil. And it's much more polluting to get out of the ground. It's much more destructive to get out of the ground, but it's also much more polluting to refine, because when you turn it into gas, you have to break off of all of those other pollutants, and they break out into the air. The local community here has stood firm and has thus far stopped Chevron from retooling this refinery to burn that type of crude. And that shows that, you know, when a community stands up, when it's supported not only by a local organizing, but also national and even international organizing in this case, it can be successful and stand up to this company. But, you know, I think anyone who's aware of the Enbridge pipeline dispute of trying to stop piping that Canadian tar sand oil into the United States knows of another victory, which is stopping that pipeline thus far. But, you know, as you raise, whether it's sending oil by tanker, trying to dig it out of the bottom of the ocean, as we learned so clearly with BP in the Gulf of Mexico, tankers with Exxon and the Valdez, moving this stuff around is dangerous, and it's dangerous at every point.
What we heard before you came on the air, Antonia, was the mayor of Richmond, Gail McLaughlin, speaking to a very concerned crowd at a town hall meeting last night. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to use her as the question as to whether her stated support for the population is characteristic of the elected representatives, and whether or not they are dependent upon oil company campaign funding or will stand up for legislation that does enforce the kind of environmental protections that you referred to in the Clean Water Act and the pollutant discharge elimination system and all of that. How embedded are the politicians in the interest of the big money oil corporations like Chevron in your area?
I mean, it's a great question, and Mayor McLaughlin is just an amazing woman and an amazing example of that we actually can, you know, have victories against the oil industry. Chevron has been in California for over 100 years. It used to have its headquarters right here in San Francisco. That became too much of the focus of protests, so they moved themselves out to a big corporate campus about 30 miles outside of the city. But this is their hometown, and the Richmond Refinery was built in 1902, and the Richmond area was always a company town forever, bought and sold by the company. But long-term, ongoing community organizing has resulted in a huge shift, and one of the first and biggest shifts was the election of Mayor McLaughlin, who's a Green Party candidate, who was an activist, local activist, elected to mayor in 2008, and she has been a constant supporter of the local community and has stood up against Chevron. And they've tried everything they could to get her unelected and to challenge every measure that she puts up against them, to challenge candidates against her, and she just has too much public support, and she keeps getting reelected. And most recently, in the last few years, the Richmond City Council has had a revolution, and Chevron candidates have essentially been forced off, and community-supported people who are willing to stand up to Chevron have now taken over the city council. And so this Chevron corporate town has really tried to change the tide, one of the reasons why it's been able to stand up against this retooling. So it is possible, and that's a message, of course, for elected officials all across the country and all across the nation, which are bought and sold by the oil industry. You know, the tide can turn against you, and when the public stands up for the type of elected officials they want, they have the chance of winning.
That's quite an inspiration. Antonia Juhas is the author of The Tyranny of Oil, and you've been working long on the Chevron issue with Global Exchange. Tell us about what you are presenting in these forums.
Sure. So one of the things I've done is with a broad network, which we call ourselves the True Cost of Chevron Network, and instead of having these small local communities, you know, that have to stand up against one of the largest corporations in the world alone and generally outside of the public view, we've linked communities impacted by Chevron all across the United States, all across the world, into one network called the True Cost of Chevron Network. And, you know, participants in the network come from places like Kazakhstan, Ecuador, Burma, Alaska, California, Canada, you name it, and we've been working with community groups, unions and activists in those areas. And one of the things we've done is for 3 years put out alternative annual reports for Chevron to have those local communities say what it really means to have Chevron operating in their communities, and put those out, and also organize to bring community members to Chevron shareholder meetings and to help raise attention to the work that they're doing and get local, national, and international support for that work, trying to carry that voice out broader than just one small local group. And that was a program that I did run at Global Exchange, which unfortunately doesn't exist anymore because it's hard to get funding when you work in the nonprofit industry to take on the oil industry. And it's definitely actually a message for activists who support nonprofit organizations. It's very hard, and many nonprofit organizations don't even try to take on the oil industry because it's so hard to get funding to do it. And the challenge is that they need to hear from their memberships. You know, if you're a member of the Sierra Club, if you're a member of Human Rights Watch, let them know that you really want them to take on the oil industry and you support them doing that.
Antonia Juhasz, you anticipate my ultimate question as to how the environmental issue domestically is connected internationally to the military issue and the oil-seeking wars of this world and this administration and the continuity of many generations of presidencies. And I still offer you the floor on that issue of globalizing the protest.
Yeah, but the work that I've moved into has increasingly focused on investigative journalism. I most recently was with the Nation Investigative Fund and writing for the Nation, and have just received a fellowship at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley to focus on oil and gas issues as they relate to the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and that's something I've been working on for years. My three books on the oil industry all address the wars and oil and gas. And, you know, really the pinnacles, hopefully, or the apex that we reached within the Bush administration was the oil industry in that administration didn't have to lobby like they do in this one. Instead, they were within the industry, within the administration. They were able to legislate. They basically dictated policy because they were the administration. And one of the things they achieved was, you know, the outright use of the military to achieve oil objectives at a minimum. Very overtly in Iraq and to a lesser degree in Afghanistan. And the American public responded to that. In 2008, when Barack Obama was elected president, one of the primary criticisms that people had of the Bush administration was its ties to the oil industry and the connection of the oil industry in the Iraq war. And obviously, things have not changed to the degree that we would like, not because, again, the oil industry is part of this administration the way it was before, but because this administration is simply not immune from the pressures of this industry. And again, it just comes back to us to counterbalance that money pressure with people pressure, and it actually, you know, can happen. But what I've been trying to do is, you know, make very clear this sense that people have that the wars are about oil, but to actually document it and to show the way that the major oil companies, Exxon, Chevron, BP, Shell, have all used the war in Iraq to gain access to that country when they hadn't been there for 30 years and are now do have access thanks to the war, the way that Exxon is now looking to move into Afghanistan for its oil, and to document the way that the wars have been used to achieve this goal as more information to help us challenge that power of the industry.
I thank you so much for the insight you've brought us today. Our guest, Antonia Juhasz, the author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry, and many other works in regard to Chevron and petroleum politics domestically and around the world. How can people follow your work, Antonia?
Twitter seems to be the most popular way these days. I'm just Antonia Juhasz on Twitter, and I also have, of course, Facebook, and my website is tyrannyofoil.org, the title of my second book.
Well, excellent. And the Twitter account is actually spelled AntoniaJuhasz, and the website tyrannyofoil.org. Thank you so much, Antonia Juhasz.
Thank you for having me.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. We'll be back with more on the Gulf of Mexico and the BP oil disaster there.
There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's a red moon rising on the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. There's an oil barge winding down the Cuyahoga River, rolling into Cleveland to the lake. Cleveland, city of light, city of magic. Cleveland, city of light, you're calling me. Cleveland, even now I can remember, 'cause the Cuyahoga River goes smoking through my dreams. Burn on, big river, burn on. Burn on, big river, burn on. Now the Lord can make you tumble, the Lord can make you turn, the Lord can make you overflow, but the Lord can't make you burn. Burn on, big river, burn on. Burn on, big river, burn on.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. We originate at WBAI, and we have been covering the Chevron refinery fire in Richmond, California. And we now look at another petroleum disaster not so far away in the Gulf of Mexico. And we are referring, of course, to the BP oil volcano explosion disaster and the consequences of all of that. And we're very happy to be joined now live by Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network based in New Orleans. And welcome to the Shadow once again, Aaron.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me and for returning your attention to our plight down here in the Gulf.
Well, there are two gulfs or bays that are under duress, of course, with the Chevron fire that continues this week after the eruption Monday and the fuming of populations overnight. And yet there is a quiet storm taking place in the Gulf of Mexico. Can you bring us up to date on how awful the consequences of that? It's called a spill, but I call it an eruption from a blowout well. And
sometimes we call it the BP drilling disaster because it truly has been a disaster and was, and I think underscored just how unprepared the oil industry is for their accidents. And that is just something that we're seeing, I think, with Chevron as well. So what we're seeing right now is there's research that's coming in, you know, and it's a little bit murky and it's not as clear. You know, we've avoided to this point the worst case scenarios, like, you know, wide-scale commercial fisheries collapses, but there's some very troubling warning signs that continue. There's an ongoing dolphin die-off. There's, you know, NOAA calls it, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration calls it a unusual mortality event. Dolphins are dying at 4 to 10 times the background rates. They're washing up constantly. We are seeing significant lesions and really some, you know, tail rot and other kind of nasty features in deep water fish that were, of course, exposed to lots of BP's oil because it was a deep water disaster. And then in the marsh, in the marshes that were hit pretty hard by BP, we're seeing problems with things like the Cockahoe minnow, which is it's a bait fish. It's really important for other marine species that eat it. And then just recently, last week, actually, researchers out of Alabama have shown convincingly that dispersant and oil, this dispersed oil especially, will throw a significant curveball at the Gulf food web. And they replicated the real-world situation that BP created 2 years ago with their oil and unprecedented toxic dispersant release. And they found that bacteria increases with a subsequent decrease in plankton production. And that's really troubling because plankton is what's really driving that food web here in the Gulf. So, you know, it really is something where every kind of intersection we look at in the food web, there are some significant warning signs with the research. And, you know, we think about this disaster with an eye towards, you know, what we've learned from previous disasters, so the Exxon Valdez. And what we saw there was that sublethal impacts accumulated to the point where four seasons after the Valdez oil spill, the herring fishery in Prince William Sound collapsed commercially. And that's something that still hasn't recovered 20-plus years later. So we're very, you know, concerned about how these sublethal impacts are working in our ecosystem and want to make sure that BP is held accountable, you know, for every impact and is, you know, is made to pay for the ecosystem restoration that's so critical.
Well, let's go over some of those issues. In the beginning, the seafood, the sea life, the pictures that we remember seeing of the once a great delicacy and economic boon to the Gulf and the Eastern Atlantic region of the seafood, the red snapper that we saw spotted and mottled now with brown blotches beyond the red scales and such. And was there also a consequence for those sea life, those forms of sea life at the bottom of the Gulf, the shellfish?
Absolutely.
And
well, we've
scavengers.
Seen there's some pretty compelling research that shows that the coral populations have suffered a significant loss of biodiversity. So these, you know, deep water corals in the Gulf of Mexico that were in the path of BP's oil and dispersant, because remember, they put the dispersant in an unprecedented application. They put the dispersant in at the seafloor where the oil was leaking out of that riser. So that's something they'd never done before, which meant that, you know, all the ecosystems were exposed to this dispersant and oil mix, which is more toxic than just the oil or just the dispersant. So that very compelling studies that are showing loss of biodiversity in these deep water reefs. We're also seeing, as you said, the red snapper with the, you know, the mottles and with the you know, these kind of lesions. And red snapper are a really important fishery because it's a commercially and recreationally very popular fishery. It's also one that, because of that popularity, wasn't doing that well. We actually had to file a lawsuit a handful of years before BP to force the National Fisheries Service to listen to their scientists and ratchet down the catch levels so the fishery could rebuild. And it was, in fact, responding very well and was rebuilding. But it's a challenge because it's a long-lived species. And they don't actually become really great breeders for as long as 10 years.
That means that the material can accumulate in them over their longer life period, that they can...
I think that is a concern, and I think it's at this point it's uncertain as to, you know, what kind of a role the dispersed oil is playing in terms of bioaccumulation, mm-hmm. and, you know, we're going to need to keep an eye on that as you know, as the impact is considered and is studied, and we're very hopeful that the study resources will be made available. We've got a bottleneck right now. The researchers I've talked to have said very clearly that there's money for research. They have lots of ideas about things they'd like to be researching. There's a very robust academic community along the Gulf and lots of different consortiums that are looking at marine impacts, but they don't have any boats. There's only a handful or fewer boats that can get out there to do these long-term studies, and so they're all backed up, and lots of research isn't being done because of that problem. And that's something we think is really significant and that NOAA needs to address and BP needs to address to ensure that researchers can get out there and do the long-term studies that are so necessary.
Aaron Viles of the Gulf Restoration Network, to return to the other item that you mentioned, the dispersant. As I understand it, it is a chemical that is not unlike the major constituent of Dawn, a dishwashing thing that claims to cut oil and grease. And if I'm not mistaken, the compound, the dispersant that was used by BP in an unprecedented way, not at a surface release, but pressurized into the bottom of the Gulf, that it breaks up the surface tension of the oil and adheres to it, but it doesn't make it disappear. And I've heard that there have been gigantic plumes of this mixture, this Brownian kind of poison floating through under the surface of the Gulf of Mexico. Is that a problem?
The dispersant certainly is a problem. What we know about it, you know, we're not 100% sure about the kind of fate and transport of this dispersant and kind of where it all ended up. But what we do know is they used an unprecedented amount, about almost 2 million gallons of dispersant, and they were kind of given a rubber stamp to go ahead to use the dispersant. EPA at some point kind of pushed back that you should use one that's a little less toxic, or tell us why you can't, and BP told them why they couldn't, and so they continued to allow this unprecedented utilization. And what we know is that there's a lot of, you know, toxic chemicals at work. It's not Dawn. This is not Dawn detergent. There are some chemical properties that are similar, but we submitted a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, to try to get the ingredients and the toxicity levels of dispersants. And what we finally got was an aggregated list of about 57 ingredients, and they all have, you know, the 57 ingredients that were found on the National Contingency Plan product schedule, which, you know, is basically a registry by EPA. Of those 57 ingredients, 8 are suspected or known to be toxic to aquatic organisms, 5 that are suspected to have moderate toxic effects, and over 33 that are associated with some potential hazard to humans, like they're associated with cancer or respiratory or kidney toxicity. So that's something where we actually released the full analysis in a report. You can find that on our website. But we pushed EPA to do more in kind of pre-testing. They, by the Oil Pollution Act of 1990, they're supposed to be doing more kind of pre-testing and having a list of conditions for dispersant application, and they just didn't have that. So we asked them to you know, follow their own rules. They did not do that. We actually just filed a lawsuit 2 days ago with the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, the Cook Inlet Keeper, Sierra Club, Louisiana Shrimp Association, and other groups, because, you know, we want to see, we want to make sure that we are better prepared for the next time an oil disaster happens. Right now, there's a lot of talk about drilling in the Arctic. They're very concerned up there about how, you know, if the EPA and the Coast Guard didn't respond adequately in the Gulf, which is what we maintain, how in the world will they be able to respond adequately in the Arctic, which is a much more challenging environment? And so the first thing they've got to do here is make sure they, you know, look at what happened, look at all the studies that are going on around dispersants and oil and their impact on the ecosystem, and use that to then set up better regulations and rules about how dispersants can be used in the future. We know that dispersants will likely be, a prominent piece of any response to the next oil spill, but we know that it's not the best option. The best option is to physically remove the oil from the ecosystem without any sort of a chemical treatment. And that's basically, you got to hold the oil industry accountable to what they say they can do in the case of a spill, because they all have these, you know, response plans, and they all promise the moon in terms of physically removing the oil through skimmers and fire booms and things of that nature. But what we saw with BP's disaster is that they never came anywhere close to fulfilling what they promised to do in terms of the physical removal, and they just, you know, went directly to the chemical treatment. We think that that's not the best approach, and we think we're probably going to see the ecosystem fallout as we kind of study more and more about this disaster, and we're already seeing these warning signs, especially with the recent research out of Alabama.
Aaron Viles is with the Gulf Restoration Network, and that report is available from them at healthygulf.org. And finally, we recall that the BP spill was presaged by a grand announcement at a military base by President Obama, saying we need more offshore oil drilling. There was a reluctant moratorium that was almost as rapidly removed or lifted as it was imposed after the BP disaster, the Macondo disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. The EPA has been asleep at the switch. What is your assessment of the continuing affinity of this administration for offshore drilling?
It is clear that they do not want to stand in the way of oil and gas exploration within, you know, federal waters. And that's unfortunate. You know, they've moved forward with a very large lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico. As I said, they're allowing these response plans to go on the books with these drilling plans that don't, you know, that I believe are still works of fiction, that they aren't really going to hold the oil industry accountable to developing the kind of fleet of skimmers to be ready for when the next oil spill happens. So I don't think that there's a huge interest in doing things such as following the recommendations of the Oil Spill Commission. So the Obama administration created the Oil Spill Commission to look at what went wrong and why offshore with the Gulf of disaster, and they came back with a lot of really sensible kind of common ground, things that other countries do, things that we could ask the oil industry to do, you know, and they haven't done well on the implementation. There's a few reasons why. One is the Obama administration. The other one, which I think is likely more significant in a number of instances, is that we had a major shift in who controlled Congress. You know, before when that oil spill commission was impaneled, and then when they returned their results of their investigation, you know, the folks who were heading up the House Committee on Natural Resources were initially folks who cared about natural resources. And when they came back with their recommendations, it were the folks who cared about giving the oil industry everything they wanted, right? That switch, that election had consequences in terms of how we responded to the BP disaster. So legally, we haven't passed a single piece of legislation to force the oil industry to be more responsive and responsible. And that's unfortunate because there's a lot of good recommendations that are right now getting dusty. The administration's done some of them through their regulations. They certainly haven't done all of them. And as you said very clearly, they seem to be very interested in allowing oil and gas exploration in a number of spots. One thing we have not given up on is something that was done in Alaska in the wake of the Exxon Valdez, which was the creation of a citizens advisory council. So a group of affected community members, the folks from these coastal fishing communities and native tribes that pay the price when the oil industry screws up, and they get funding and resources and technical staff and a relationship with the oil industry to check their response plans, to give them insights, to give them, you know, advice about how you are better prepared for accidents or how you minimize your impact, and kind of force the oil industry to have that transparency and community accountability. We've got a great track record up in Alaska with the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. We think the Gulf desperately needs that model. And we want to see it stood up, whether it's through the settlement, which is still outstanding. The BP has not paid, really, to fix what they broke. They've not been held accountable for everything that they've done. We think it's a great opportunity within that settlement to get some more transparency and citizen accountability. Or it's certainly something that could be done legislatively or through regulations within Department of the Interior or even Coast Guard. So I think there's a lot of opportunities to learn the lessons of the BP disaster. It's something that the Oil Spill Commission recommended as well, but we do need more help, more support to make sure that happens.
We certainly recommend that our listeners do attend your work at the website healthygulf.org and support the Gulf Restoration Network. And I thank you so much for the compelling update that you've provided us with today, Aaron Viles.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your interest. We appreciate it.
All right. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the theme today is that the environment is very closely related to the conduct of the economy, which is in turn dependent upon its primary energy sources here in the still fossil fuel dependent economy and energy system of the United States, which means oil, which means the acquisition of it after the peak production periods and it's becoming more expensive to extract, ergo fracking. And so in pursuit of oil, in other parts of the world, there are wars, wars of opportunity that have pretexts that always end up in the places where there are oil. And these issues have to do with whether a war economy reduces the productivity and brings us back to the failure of an economy that does not produce while in pursuit of war, in pursuit of oil. These are some of the issues that were recently discussed by Robert Manga Beira Unger. He is a Brazilian philosopher and professor of economics. In fact, he taught Barack Obama at the Harvard Law School in the subject of jurisprudence and, ironically enough, reinventing democracy. And here now are Roberto Unger's thoughts on these matters.
Neither of the two major political parties offers the country what it needs. The Republican Party imagines that if only government became less costly and restrictive, with lower taxes and fewer regulations, economic growth would make up for inequality. If this party had its way, inequality would become even greater than it is now, and threaten freedom and prosperity even more than it now does. The Democratic Party proposes no new direction. Its idea is to put a human face on the program of its adversaries, to implement their program with a humanizing discount, give the bond markets what they want, bail out the reckless so long as they are also rich, use fiscal and monetary stimulus to make up for the absence of any consequential broadening of economic and educational opportunity, sweeten the pill of disempowerment with a touch of tax fairness, even though the effect of any such tax reform is sure to be modest. This is less a project than it is an abdication. America sees with vitality. Nowhere in the world is there more energy and ingenuity diffused through the whole population. Much of this talent goes wasted. The deepest cause of the financial and economic crisis that the United States has recently undergone is that the country stopped producing at competitive prices enough goods and services that the rest of the world wants. It then tried to escape the consequences of this failure by living as if the failure had not occurred. It put a fake credit democracy in place of the property-owning democracy that it turned into an ever more distant ideal. The government bribed, placated, and finally abandoned the people instead of equipping them. What then should the program be? Enlist finance in the service of the real economy rather than allowing it to serve itself. Broaden the gateways of access to the vanguards of innovative knowledge-based production and disseminate advanced experimental productive practices among the small and medium-sized businesses that form the heart of the American economy. Make available to all Americans a type of education that accords priority to capabilities, both conceptual and practical, of analysis, synthesis, and recombination of ideas and of things. And to this end, reconcile the local management of the schools with national standards of investment and quality. Engage society in the competitive provision of public services as the best way of enhancing their quality, while using the powers of government to ensure a universal minimum of provision. Insist on the high level of taxation required for the financing of such alternatives. What matters in the short term is the overall level of the tax take and how it is spent. Later on, it can be made more progressive through a steeply progressive tax on individual consumption. And above all, take politics out of the shadow of money. This program fails to fit within the limits of the two major progressive traditions in American history. One tradition defends small-scale property and small business. Another tradition seeks to regulate big business so that it not damage the public interest. It is no longer enough to protect small business or to regulate big business, or to attenuate economic inequalities through compensatory redistribution by taxation and transfer payments. We need to democratize the market, to renew its institutional arrangements so that more people can have more access to more markets in more ways, so that they can stand on their own feet and make something of themselves. We cannot democratize the market economy unless we also deepen democracy. President Obama must be defeated in the coming election. He has failed to advance the progressive cause in the United States. He has spent trillions of dollars to rescue the moneyed interests and left workers and homeowners to their own devices. He has subordinated the broadening of economic and educational opportunity to the important but secondary issue of access to health care, in the mistaken belief that he would be spared a fight. He has disguised his surrender with an empty appeal to tax justice. He has delivered the politics of democracy to the rule of money. He has reduced justice to charity. His policy is financial confidence and food stamps. He has evoked a politics of hand-holding, but no one changes the world without a struggle. Unless he is defeated, there cannot be a contest for the reorientation of the Democratic Party as the vehicle of a progressive alternative in the country. There will be a cost for his defeat in judicial and administrative appointments. The risk of military adventurism, however, under the rule of his opponents, will be no greater than it would be under him. Only a political reversal can allow the voice of democratic prophecy to speak once again in American life. Its speech is always dangerous. Its silence is always fatal.
The words of Roberto Unger, the Brazilian philosopher, politician, economist, and educator who taught Barack Obama in his course, Reinventing Democracy, at Harvard Law School. And that concludes today's edition of 5 o'clock Shadow. The program was engineered by Michael G. Haskins and produced by Thiago Barroso. And we welcome your comments, tips, questions, leaks, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.